In our study this morning, as we discuss the subject of the New Testament lands, beginning on page number 26 in your lesson book, we've noted that the area to the north of the Mediterranean Sea is an area where obviously people were living, and some are discussed in Old Testament history. In particular, the Hittites are discussed as being some who were the inhabitants of at least a portion of the land that would affect the people of Israel. And yet, as we discuss the Hittites, as a number of times they're mentioned in Old Testament text, there were those who did not believe or questioned whether or not the Bible was accurate in making any reference to the Hittites, because archaeological finds and so forth had not lended evidence to the existence of a people known as the Hittites. But in more recent archaeological discoveries, they have indeed found that the Hittite society did exist, just as the Bible tells us that it did. Now, one of the things that I want you to note is in our study of history and geography of the Bible, we're looking at the accuracy of the text itself. When we look at the credibility of the Scriptures, even such topographical references as they went up or they went down, all of these things are crucial to the total accuracy of the Scriptures. For example, when we look in the New Testament and read of those who were Judaizing teachers who went down from Jerusalem to Antioch, binding circumcision upon those Gentiles who were in Antioch. We have, in our study so far, noted the variances of elevation from the coastal plain to the hill country to the Jordan River Valley, and then up to the Transjordan, and then going north from Jerusalem that was located on the hill country, as it were, about 2,700 feet elevation. Going then to Antioch was a decline in elevation. So we have 100% accuracy even in such terms as went up or went down. And so we're going to be noticing those. When we talk about the peoples that inhabited the land, to note that the Scriptures are 100% accurate in describing these people, it's essential to notice these things in our passing, and we're going to do that. Notice, if you will, that little is mentioned in the Old Testament concerning the lands on the northern shores of the Mediterranean Sea. But yet there were people that lived there, and they lived there before the Israelites lived in the land of Canaan. And these, some of these, are mentioned in the statements that God made unto characters such as Abraham. Now, when we talk about the Hittites, north of the Halys River. Now, again, we're in the process. Richard, I thank you so much for the research you're doing on a different projector, but I want you to see that these areas are in the northern portion of the area that we're talking about. This map is small. Of course, here's Canaan. Here's the Black Sea, Europe, and here is the area of the Hittites, and here's the Halys River, and you want to remember that for our future studies on these maps. The Hittite people, they traded with the people in the Fertile Crescent. Now, Richard talked with you about these things last Wednesday night and Sunday, as the Fertile Crescent was this area involving Mesopotamia and down in through Canaan, as you saw on those maps that he presented to you. Now, when we think about the Hittites, one of the things that ought to come to mind during the time of Abraham is that Abraham bought a cave in which to bury his wife from a Hittite. You can read about that in Genesis chapter 23, and you'll also note that that became the burial place or the sepulchers of the fathers, where not only Abraham and Sarah were buried, but also Isaac and Rebekah were buried, and also Jacob and Leah were buried in this burying place that Abraham bought from this Hittite. The nation of the Hittites were never really in direct conflict with the Israelites. Now, I want you to notice briefly with me that the Hittite area came down actually just barely north of the land of the Canaanites. So though there was no direct conflict with the Israelites, they were really not all that far removed. Another thing that I want us to remember as we study these charts, the locations of these places. Civilization on the island of Crete. Now, Crete, as far as Old Testament study is concerned, is not a very prominent place in biblical study. But when we think about New Testament study, Crete becomes a very important place. Why? One of our New Testament books is written to a preacher who predominantly preached on the Isle of Crete. Who was he? Titus. That's right. And what do we learn about the Cretans? All right. Paul said Cretans have a reputation. What was their reputation? They're liars. That's right. So that outlines for you at least some of the work that Titus had cut out for him. The Cretans were notable for being liars. Now, in the New Testament, that rings bells. But when we look back into the Old Testament, though the Isle of Crete specifically is not that prominent, those who inhabited the island of Crete came to the border of the land of Canaan and dwelt in the land known as the Philistines, or identified as the Philistines. They did butt heads a lot with the children of Israel on a number of occasions. You may recall on occasions with King Saul, with King David, and so seemingly a constant thorn in the flesh for the people of God during this time. But this civilization began on the Isle of Crete that did influence ultimately God's people. Now, this particular portion of or series of charts, Richard, is not in the ones that you and I have by Brother Thetford. I want you to notice the development of history from the maps, the charts. This is impressive to me and helpful in my study. When we go back to the time of the United Kingdom in Old Testament history, during the days of King Saul, King David, and King Solomon, this map depicting the prominent period of time under the reign of King David and King Solomon, and then as we come to the period of the divided kingdom, where King Solomon's son, Rehoboam, imposed his stubbornness upon the people of Israel when they asked that the burdens be made lighter. King Rehoboam, through his foolishness, divided the kingdom. And that's what's represented on this chart. I simply want to call your attention to the Assyrian Empire to the north that became a threat to those who would worship idols. God had promised them when they were on their way to the promised land that when you worship idols, I'll destroy you. You can read that multiple times in Deuteronomy chapter 4, beginning in verse 24 and 25, for example. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, Deuteronomy chapter 28 through chapter 30, during the period of the blessings and the curses that Moses pronounced, and that long before they ever came into the promised land. And then also you'll notice that threat at the end of Joshua's leadership into the promised land as he had conquered the land for them and affirmed to them in Joshua chapter 21, beginning in verse 43, that everything God promised, He did. Everything. Not one thing failed. And then you want to underscore in your mind, make a note of this, in Joshua chapter 23, beginning about verse 14. For there Joshua told them that just as God did everything that He promised to do, when He brought you into the land Not one thing failed. Just as surely as he did that. You look in Joshua 23, beginning in verse 16, and you'll see Joshua assuring them that if you worship idols, God will destroy you out of this good land. Now that's important. Make a mental note of that. If not, write it down. We're going to come across it several times in our studies. But we do see that the Assyrian Empire did indeed come in and conquer the northern 10 tribes as a result of their idolatrous practices. We note that they were not successful in conquering Judah during the days of King Hezekiah because the southern kingdom remained faithful to God. But when the southern kingdom began to worship and serve idols, God raised up the Babylonians and took the Assyrians and his people captive because of their idolatry. Now, you don't see Assyria on this map, neither do you see that little dot of Judah, because of their worship of idols. Now, the Medes and the Persians were in power during the time of the closing of the Old Testament. Now, that's important to us. Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, had written a decree by the prophecy of God, which you will want to note this passage, in Isaiah 44 and 45, the conclusion of chapter 44, the first part of chapter 45, noting that Isaiah the prophet wrote when in the history of Israel. I said I wasn't going to go back and do all this Old Testament stuff again, but I can't help it. Just can't help myself, friend. All right? When did Isaiah prophesy? About 800, 750, 800 B.C., noting that that time frame was when what events were happening in the history of Israel. All right. All right, you're very, very close. Isaiah prophesying during that time frame when Assyria conquered Samaria was about 722 B.C. So Isaiah writing just prior to that. And then telling them that here's what God's going to do with Assyria. Here's what he's going to do with Babylon. But then he's going to raise up a king named Cyrus who will rule over this empire, and he'll write a decree and let you go home. Now that's significant because that dates these events for us. About so. Before Cyrus was even born, before there was even a kingdom for Cyrus to rule over. And he's named by name. And we're told what he would do. And it's during the reign of the Medes and the Persians that Cyrus wrote the decree, allowed them to go home, and they began to rebuild. And of course, it's there that we've talked about the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai. What did he do? What did Haggai do? All right, the temple, and then Ezra and Nehemiah in particular, rebuilding the walls around the city of Jerusalem. Now, that's all during this period. Now, when we come to the period of the close of the Old Testament, we look at the writing of the book of Malachi. Now, we found a people that have been returned. They are worshiping God. They are offering sacrifices. But what kind of sacrifices are they offering? The book of Malachi. That's right. The lame, the sick, that which is about to die anyway. You think God will accept that? He said he wouldn't. What did Malachi challenge them to do with that kind of sacrifice? Now give it to your governors. Think he'll accept it? No, he won't accept that. Now, when the book of Malachi closes, this is what's going on. This is the map that we're looking at. Now, here we have a period of the land of Canaan, simply identifying the period of the return. Now, in between the Testaments, sometimes because we have no biblical account of the events between the Old Testament and the New Testament, we wonder, well, really what happened as far as world events are concerned during that frame of time? First of all, how long was it? About 400 years. What happened between the Old and the New Testament? We don't find the Medes and the Persians empowered anymore. Alexander the Great, yes. That's right. That's right. We don't want to leave the impression they didn't exist. They're there. They're bubbling. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. So during this interim period, we've got the Alexandrian Empire or the Grecian Empire, as you talked about, I believe, Wednesday in the class, and discussed some of these things. Okay. This particular map, David, as you've introduced some of this, you might go into greater detail with some of this because of your specific knowledge of his work. But Alexander, he wasn't content just to sit over there, was he? He wanted to dominate all of it. So he began to come into this area of Canaan. Now, why? Why in Alexander's exploits does he do this? All right. Now, in thinking about the trade routes, we've talked about the significance of the trade routes going through here. How else do you control the commerce of the Mediterranean world without this? Why is this then so important? You mentioned trade routes, three of them, that go up through this area. It's a choke point. A very good term. It's a choke point. I don't know... I didn't mention it, and I didn't go back and listen specifically. Did you talk about the lava beds over here on the... Oh, you did, okay. So that makes it more of a choke point. The lava beds over on the eastern side of the Transjordan Plateau, the edge of the Arabian Desert, was actually larger than the land of Canaan. So it became very much a choke point to control this unique area. And so Alexander the Great is determined. He has to have that. But not only does he have to have that, he has to have the riches of Egypt. Now, that's an interesting study in and of itself. You talked a bit last time about the Nile River over 4,000 miles long and how that the Egyptians looked upon the Nile River as the gift of the gods. And you can see why. They did not believe it had a source. Well, if you lived in an ancient place like this where travel was not as at ease as it is today, would you consider over 4,000 miles to be quite a long way? If you saw this magnificent river running beside your back porch, would you say, I want to travel to see where that starts? Well, when you get up to the southern portions of the Nile River, you find that there are huge bends where it actually flows the opposite direction that you traveled a few days ago. And then you get up a little bit further and you find tributaries, and you find more tributaries and more tributaries. Do you suppose after 4,000 plus miles, you might think this thing just doesn't have a beginning? And thus, it's the gift of the gods. You see why that when water was turned to blood in Egypt, this was such a major thing. When we think of the control of the known world, the river Nile provided life to Egypt. There really wasn't much life you get out away from the river. And so Alexander, during the exploits of Alexander the Great, he had to have that. But not just that. Where else did he travel? He had to travel all the way to India. And some have said that Alexander went so far that he sat down and cried because there wasn't anything else to conquer. Others, more correctly, I believe, reveal that he went so far that his soldiers sat down and cried because they would not go any farther. Now, that's interesting. But this is the area that we're talking about now as we're coming closer to New Testament times. The rule of Alexander the Great. And then, of course, he made his trip with his army back toward Greece. Now, you talked about this. By New Testament times, the emphasis shifts then from Egypt and Mesopotamia to the whole Mediterranean world. And we see why that becomes such an important development during the New Testament era. Judah is under Persian control when the Old Testament closes. Their capital was east of the Tigris River. During the period between Malachi and Matthew, the Persians were defeated by the Greeks, and then we've talked about the army of Alexander the Great and his determination to make the known world Greek. Now, one of the ways that he wanted to do that is to make the Greek language, its customs, its culture, spread throughout the world. Now, how did he do that? How do you make the culture of one area, how do you diversify that all over the known world? You conquer them, yes. You import people, and all right, and then you set up models of that so that you can venture out from those places. And Alexandria in Egypt, for example, becomes one of those model cities to spread the culture of the Greek language, customs, and so forth. And that was the way that Alexander attempted to do that. Now, when we think about Alexander the Great, this map depicts the whole area that he attempted to exercise his dominion over. But as we come into New Testament times, Rome, as David has pointed out, is not just non-existent, it's sitting back there bubbling, waiting for an opportunity to expand its empire. And so it rose to a position of power during these years of biblical silence. Palestine fell to Rome in 63 B.C. and was in power during the time of Christ. Now, I want to call your attention to the significance of the development of these nations and the sequence of these nations as we look at Old Testament prophecies relative to them. Turn, if you will, to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. Once again, I want to beg your indulgence because we are continuing to set the stage for the things that we're going to be discussing in greater detail from the biblical text. But but we want to set the stage by knowing the locations on the globe that we are discussing and what brings us to those locations. In Daniel chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. What is it? Jenny? All right, excellent. And what do these represent? Different kingdoms. All right, and now we know that's so. How do we know that's so? I'm picking on you. Exactly right, verse 44 of this text. And these sequence of kings do indeed come to pass. And as we come to New Testament times, who is it that is ruling? Caesar, that's right. We're going to be talking just briefly about the Caesars. Now, in order for Rome to reach such a dominant position, they're not done like any of the others of these kingdoms. They see the importance of this strategic little strip of land. Just as we've illustrated on all of our charts thus far, identifying these who inhabited the area around Canaan. If you go anywhere, you have to pass through Canaan. If you control any commerce, you have to control Canaan. If you control any of the trade, you have to control these trade routes. Because, as Richard used the expression, not bottleneck, what was it? Choke point. You have to have Canaan. You have to have it. And that is what Rome has to have as well. Yes. That's true. Good observation. I hadn't really thought about it that much, but that's right. Excellent. Any other comment or question just here? Do you see how that on our chart, that what we have emphasized predominantly in Old Testament text has been this Fertile Crescent area? But now what we are looking at is the entirety of the Mediterranean world. Now, this is the beginning of New Testament times, the days of the Roman Empire. Now, you'll see at the top of this chart. I'm sorry, Randy, I didn't see you. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. 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 And you can see why when you see the topography of the land and what it has to offer. Who gets what is crucial. Yes. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Which gave the Romans a significant edge, particularly as we think about the Syrians that we had on one of the previous maps. Yeah. When did Greece take Palestine? I think I had that on one of the maps, but I don't recall. Seleucids, yeah. This is the portion of Daniel that you were talking about with Antiochus Epiphanes and the events pertaining to that. But, okay. All right. The time draws near. And, of course, we've got Rome now beginning to expand. Here is about 200 years before Christ. They begin to expand into the area of Spain and then head eastward into Macedonia. Almost 200 years, 197 B.C., and then on over into Asia, and then Rome demands tax of Syria. Now, this is what you were talking about a few moments ago. We've got this period of time where the Syrians are trying to defile the temple and so forth in Jerusalem, and so Rome just sits back and waits for Syria to become weakened, and then begins to demand taxes of Syria. Now, what are you going to do? You're already in a weakened state. So then we find that Rome continues to expand. Parthia threatens Syria, and then Syria becomes a Roman province in 64 B.C. You see what's happening? Rome continues to expand. And, of course, the Maccabean revolt against the Syrians during this period of time. Also, we will discuss in significant detail when we get a little bit further along in this intertestamental period. Julius Caesar begins to invade, and Pompey is defeated and fled to Egypt in 48 B.C., where he is eventually killed. And then Julius Caesar moves to Egypt, where Cleopatra is made the ruler of Egypt. And then we read of the prominence of Antipas. His son Herod the Great is made the king of the Jews. And the rest, as they say, is history. Julius Caesar murdered in 444 B.C. And then Cleopatra is in power, 44. What did I say? Oh, well, I may have. I may have. But 44 B.C. And, of course, we see the events continue to develop until Luke chapter 2, where we note that Octavian is declared the first Roman emperor titled Augustus Caesar. In Luke chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, thus the beginning of the New Testament record with the Romans on the throne. Okay? So time draws near. Rome. Richard, you talked about some of these things last time. Rome never managed to defeat the Parthians. The Jews resented the Roman control of their land. They were constantly seeking ways to overthrow Rome. Rome needed Palestine to complete the control of the sea. The strategic location of this little country was seen clearly by Rome. Now, I want to comment just briefly. The Jews resented the Roman control of their land.
cite me a for instance. What bears record of their resentment? All right. But they always had been under bondage, for the most part. They had always been under bondage. They'd born in bondage. That's right. And at the very time, they were under the thumb of Rome. Yes. All right. All right. There are multiple illustrations of their resentment of having to pass Roman approval before they could do anything. In the history of Paul's arrest and persecutions, we see evidence of that. Yeah. So these are evidences of that, and you talked about that, I think, some in your study Wednesday night. Now, I want to look on this portion of our study as we talk about Asia. Now, we're down at the lower part of page 26, if you're looking in your lesson book. When the Bible speaks of Asia, it's referring to a Roman province on the northern shores of the Mediterranean Sea in what is known as Asia Minor. Today, you see that on this small map. You'll see it, I think, in your book on a much larger map, Asia Minor. Asia Minor becomes so important in our New Testament studies because of the preaching tours of the Apostle Paul. Those of you who have been studying with us in our Acts study and to some degree in our study of Bible authority, we've been talking about Paul's travels in the latter portion, in particular, of the book of Acts. We note that he crossed the Aegean Sea into Europe, and he preached in Macedonia and Achaia. And I want you to be familiar with this portion on the northern edge of the Mediterranean Sea, the Aegean Sea that separated Asia from Greece. Do you see that? I should have had a larger map in this series at this point. But you may see that in your lesson book, the Aegean Sea. That becomes very significant to us when we consider the epistles in connection with the writings, or the travels, rather, of the Apostle Paul. You'll note the island of Cyprus, Crete, Melita, and Patmos. How did all of these play a prominent role in the study of the New Testament? When we think of Cyprus, this little island here, when Paul began to preach, being sent out by the church in Antioch. He sailed from Antioch and he went to this island. And you'll note that there are cities that are mentioned, Salamis and, pardon me, there's one on the east and one on the west end. Just drawn blank. Acts 13. Hate it when that happens. Salamis and Paphos. And so this is on the island of Cyprus. Now here's Crete over here. We know that when Paul is on his way to Rome as a prisoner, he sails on the lee side of Crete. And, of course, that island takes on significance. Melita, way on over here, off of this map, is where the shipwreck took place. And so there are significant places that we'll want to talk about when we get a little bit further along in our study. All right, Paul's work in Asia. Oh, here's the map I was looking for. Paul's first preaching journey, leaving Antioch. Here it is, the Isle of Cyprus, Salamis, and Paphos, as he comes up into Asia from the south. And then on his second preaching tour, leaving Antioch and then to Tarsus and on through Asia to Troas and then up into Macedonia and Achaia, Asia again playing a very prominent role as Paul returns to Ephesus, one of the seven churches of Asia Minor, as you'll note in Revelation chapter 2. And then in the third preaching tour, as Paul leaves Antioch, once again traveling through Asia, and then going up into Macedonia and Achaia, and then backtracking, coming back, touching Asia at Miletus, and then returning to Jerusalem. So Asia plays a very prominent role in our New Testament geography, and we want to notice that at this point as we are passing through. Now, the Roman Empire in the days of Christ. I forgot why I put that map on here. As Paul writes to those in Rome, in Romans the 15th chapter, we see Paul's desire expressed to visit those saints in Rome. Now, you read that in Romans chapter 15. Those of you in our authority study notice, of course, the significance of that. As Paul has traveled through Asia and up through Macedonia and down into Achaia, where he writes the Roman letter, having expressed the desire to go to Jerusalem and then to Rome and then to travel on his way to Spain. What I want you to see in this map is the enormous area controlled by the Roman Empire. Everything around the Mediterranean Sea controlled by Rome. Why? Commerce. That's right. It's interesting to note that the Roman Empire was not especially interested in traveling, for example, over into the Arabian Desert and conquering that. Why? Not much commerce there. No. When you go on down into the interior of Egypt, they weren't particularly concerned about that. Why? When you get away from the River Nile, what's there? The Sahara. There's nothing there. So when you're talking about wealth of the empire, you're talking about that which was the commerce that revolved around the travel of the Mediterranean Sea. Rome had it. And that's what existed during the days of Christ, during the days of the New Testament. Now, there's a question, perhaps, that we haven't given a great deal of consideration to, and that is in chapter 4, and in verse 4, when the text there tells us that in the fullness of times, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, that He might redeem them that were under the law, that ye might receive the adoption of sons. The point I want to focus on is that expression, in the fullness of times. Do you see any relevance to the geography, the political boundaries that we've been discussing this morning to bring us to the point of New Testament times? David and then Richard. All right. He hit them both. All right. Let me throw one more. All right, David, go ahead. You may have it. That's right. Now that was my point. That's right. That's exactly right. Jews were scattered, as we have seen on these maps. And Paul could go into almost any city and find a Jewish synagogue. He could find the Old Testament text being read every Sabbath day in the synagogue. And so there was a foundation on which to build. That's right. Okay, that's right. All right. Well, lots more to say about that. The worksheet that's on pages 6, or lesson 6 and 7, discussing 6 and 7, on page 27. Be sure you have that done for next time. Okay? Have the worksheet done on page 26 and 27, and be prepared to discuss lesson number 8, the dating of Bible events. That begins on page 29. Dating Bible events. Now the significance of that is going to clearly be seen. Spend some time with that. We're not going to focus, just throw this out, we're not going to focus on the exactness of some of those dates, because some sources that you refer to may vary by a year or two. What we want to focus on in particular is the order of the events. Okay? All right, so spend some time with lesson number 8.